COVID-19 is quickly circulating throughout the province of Quebec. It's essential that you get tested only if you have COVID-like symptoms. Symptoms such as fever, cough, and loss of taste or loss of smell. As you may already know, testing still remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. For more information, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. Happy New Year to all of our listeners, and welcome to the first Mondo Weiss Podcast episode of 2022. In November of last year, a Palestinian Day of Solidarity was held in Philadelphia. At the event, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney delivered a proclamation in solidarity with the Palestinians. Our U.S. correspondent, Michael Aria, spoke with one of the local organizers, Jude Hussein.
At Mondo Weiss, we're always very interested in how the fight for Palestine breaks down for people across the country within their own communities. For somebody who maybe isn't familiar with Philadelphia when it comes to this issue, before we get to the day, I was wondering if maybe you could set the scene for us in terms of, you know, is there a large Palestinian community in Philly? Does that community have inroads into local politics? What's the state of Palestine activism there? Just any information that you think might be important for people to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms specifically of Philadelphia, I mean, according to the census, there's thousands of Arabs. And within that, there's thousands of Palestinians from all across Palestine, from the north to the south to the cities. So we have a couple thousand Palestinians that reside in Philadelphia. I mean, we have business owners such as GQ Aviation, you know, a flight school that is owned and operated by a Palestinian, multiple, you know, food service businesses that are operated by Palestinians. So, you know, the Palestinian community here is pretty strong as it comes to entrepreneurs, as it comes to students, community, just in general, the Philly area specifically in that in that realm has a strong Palestinian hold. When it comes to politics, there's really no Palestinian representation in the city of Philadelphia government, which, you know, is a little bit concerning, right? Because like there's so many intellectuals. Palestinians are intellectuals, they're scholars, they're lawyers and doctors and entrepreneurs. So there's that, you know, and there's activists. So it's a little bit concerning that there's no Palestinian representation in formal political office.
I wanted to talk about the event in terms of, you know, you don't see this kind of event obviously organized very often across the United States. Talk to me a little bit about how it was organized and how it ultimately came about.
My effort spans to about 2 years ago, right? I think a lot of people, so in Philadelphia, we have the Parkway where there are flags from every single country that is almost every single country that is represented on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. And then also in Philadelphia, we have flag raisings. Now, this doesn't mean your flag is represented on the parkway. It just means that, you know, there is about a 20-minute ceremony where a flag is being raised for a community that resides in Philadelphia, right? So that celebrates that, you know, there's this heritage and culture that resides in Philadelphia, not necessarily that, you know, there is a flag on the parkway. So throughout the span of 2 years, I think there were different efforts trying to raise a flag on the parkway and have it there permanently, and also having just a flag raising, you know, and we were, you know, we just wanted to have Palestine represented in any way possible. So after a lot of different organizers realized that efforts were kind of sporadic, they were separate. We all came together and a team of four. So I'm one of four that came together and, you know, said, what's going on? Why are we getting rejected for the flag on the raising, for the flag on the parkway? Why are we being rejected for a flag raising? I mean, there are thousands of Palestinians that reside in Philadelphia. What is this? So then come to know that, you know, apparently the policy, which is not public, stated there needs to be a consulate in the United States of America for us to have a flag raising. But Puerto Rico doesn't have a consulate in the United States of America, right? There's so many other countries that are represented on the parkway and that have their respective flag raisings that don't have a consulate. So I was just in utter shock, right? I mean, it's right there in your face. It's right there, plain as day. And to be told that, that was, you know, that was in itself a discrimination. I mean, that was just not what we are going to stand for. We're not asking for special treatment. We're not asking for a special process. We're not asking to jump through hoops. We want to do it the right way within the system. So the conversation went onward with the city of Philadelphia. And I said, well, November 29th is the International Day of Solidarity for the Palestinian People by the UN. And it is celebrated globally through conferences, through flag raisings, through, you know, shows, whatever the case may be. And Philadelphia is going to have something. And we are requesting the mayor to show up. We are asking for elected political, local and state officials to show up and recognize a community that has lived in Philadelphia since all the way. We can prove that we've been here since the 1950s, that we've contributed socially, economically, culturally to the city of Philadelphia. That is a sanctuary city. You know, that is an open city that allows anyone and everyone to come and really build a life here. So that was a little bit of the conversation that happened. And the mayor came out, he gave a formal proclamation. We had officials on the local state level. And I want to say almost every single level of government was there, all the way up to Congress, which was really phenomenal.
I wanted to actually touch on something you just said. You mentioned that Mayor Kenney attended. He faced a lot of backlash, it seemed, from local pro-Israel groups. I'm wondering if you could address that at all. And I'm also wondering, since this event happened, if there's been any additional backlash locally.
Yeah, absolutely. Mayor Kenney did show up. He gave his remarks. He handed the formal proclamation. And that was really a groundbreaking moment. We experienced, you know, we had a letter that got sent out from the Israeli, ambassador from New York City, you know, asking Mayor Kenney to withdraw his support. And, you know, that is just a narrative that we've seen time and time again. This wasn't about Israel or Palestine. This was about a Palestinian community that represents, you know, Palestine here in the United States of America, that, you know, they are trying to occupy us and change the narrative here as well. And I think the support of Mayor Kenney showed that Philadelphia does not back down to bullies. You know, and that's what simply it was. The local backlash that we received was someone trying to bully us, you know, bully a voice. And I think the message was clear as day. You know, we're not going to back down. We're here. We're alive. We exist. We are in all forms of things. Like I said, we're scholars, we're business owners, we're all types of things. And I think after the event, I think everyone was just in shock. Like, oh my God, you know, this is a statement, this is history, and this is going to be a reoccurring day, and we're not going to go away. And there's a point I really want to make, you know, someone said at the event, you know, you can occupy us over there for the time being, but you can't occupy us here too. And I think that is such a strong, strong statement that, you know, I said throughout my speech. And I think just the support that we've received really overpowers the hatred that we received too.
This really does feel like a historic event in terms of, you know, the entire country. I'm wondering, were you aware of any similar events being held throughout the U.S. or have you been in contact with any activists who are looking at, you know, see Philadelphia as kind of an inspiration to do this themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a lot of many activists reach out and, you know, state how proud and how inspired they are. I mean, we have Jersey City who had their first formal flag raising a week before this. You know, that in itself was historic. I mean, we had the Arab American Institute cover this and, you know, pave the way for other cities to, hey, if you want to do this, you know, reach out to these organizers, you know. And, you know, this was very hard to pull off because of the powers that be, right? The political atmosphere, the tension that no one wants to be labeled anti-Semitic. But this isn't anti-Semitism, right? Like Jews and Muslims are united. They have been united, you know, but that is what the narrative always wants to switch to. But that is not the case. This is not a religion issue. This is strictly a political, you know, issue at play where I think different cities are now looking and saying, hey, like, this is phenomenal. You know, we want to check this out. And I don't have permission to say who reached out to me just yet. But yeah, you know, we had three or four other cities say this is absolutely phenomenal. But that fear of being bullied into a corner is still there and still present. But it's breaking apart slowly but surely. And I think this event definitely proves that.
I wanted to ask about a shift when it comes to support for the Palestinian cause within, you know, communities in the U.S. Something I've noticed many times this year, speaking with activists, is that they identify the recent attack on Gaza as an event that really seemed to push people in their communities to come around on the issue who maybe otherwise would have had a blind spot, or, you know, inspired people to educate themselves on the issue, maybe progressives or liberals who hadn't historically. I'm wondering if you've seen a similar shift within Philadelphia when it comes to the work you do.
Absolutely. I think, you know, people are so much more curious, especially now with social media covering a lot more over the past year with the attacks on Gaza, with Sheikh Jarrah and what happened there over the summer, and how, you know, someone from Long Island can go to a different country and say, hey, you know, if I don't take it, someone else will. And that shift that people want to learn, well, how is that? Like, how is that possible? And what we thought was truly possibly a democratic state. Like, how did that even come to play? Like, why don't Palestinians have the same rights as Israelis? You know, why is that even up for debate? Why is that even a question that someone can just come into your neighborhood and take what's yours? But definitely, I've seen an extreme shift, especially with social media. You know, people always ask me questions. Tell me about Palestine. Tell me what it's like being a Palestinian, or tell me about, you know, do Israelis and Palestinians hate each other? Like, what's going on there? I think there has been a serious shift. And I think for the most part, it's been social media, not the mainstream media, but those local activists at work, really trying to combat the misinformation, the destruction of the narratives changing, to try to battle, you know, there's so many different ways that take away from the Palestinian cause, you know. And at the end of the day, it's very simple, like peace for the Palestinian people, you know, peace for the Palestinian people. I can't express that enough, and understanding it. And I always leave someone when they say, what can we do? Right. I say, well, you have a network of people that you can speak to them, organize, build that trust, that community trusted messenger. You know, that's the first step of everything, really educating people, and not through hatred, but through open dialogue, and ask those hard questions that are uncomfortable.
Well, this has been really informative. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWeiss.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics.
أشباح أرض قصية ما رأتها
Hello, and welcome to the CJP Me Debrief Podcast, where we discuss breaking events and issues in Canada related to human rights in Palestine and the broader Middle East. Together, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's controversial definition of anti-Semitism continues to be considered by governments and institutions at all levels across Canada. Yet many people are concerned that the definition unfairly equates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, and many supporters of Palestinian human rights in Canada are concerned that their voices will be silenced because of IHRA. Today, we'll talk about the controversial aspects of IHRA, the source of these legitimate concerns, and what the definition's many critics in Canada are saying. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. My name is Tom Woodley. I'm the president of CJPME and the podcast host for today. With me is Michael Bukert, CJPME's VP and our podcast co-host. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon.
So we're talking about the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism today. IHRA, I-H-R-A, is a fast way to refer to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, an organization which is currently the custodian of a working definition of anti-Semitism. Many people refer to this definition as the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism, or just the IHRA definition. The definition was actually proposed by a group of international academics in 2005 and was eventually adopted by IHRA in 2016. In Canada, the definition has gotten a large amount of attention these past few years and has been considered for adoption at many levels at different institutions and governments. In 2019, Canada's federal cabinet adopted the IHRA definition. In 2020, Ontario's government adopted the IHRA definition. And this past summer, Quebec's government adopted the IHRA definition. So, Michael, what actually is this definition? Why don't you read it to us?
Sure. So the definition itself is pretty short and somewhat uncontroversial, unnotable, really. Two sentences. I'll just read it. Anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish communal institutions and religious facilities.
Yeah, well, obviously it seems like a relatively reasonable definition of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a problem in Canada and elsewhere, of course. But so what are people's objections to the definition?
Sure. So if it was just those two sentences, there would be no issue here. You know, it's kind of a weak definition, but there's nothing problematic about it, really. So the issue is when you get into these illustrative examples that are often connected to the definition and which try to give a sense of how to interpret the definition, to give people guidance of when criticism of Israel or Zionism crosses the line into anti-Semitism for many of these cases.
Right, right. So you have the definition and then you have these examples. And I guess that's part of the problem, isn't it? What is the relation between the two? And we'll dig into that a little bit more. So you point out that we have these, they call them illustrative examples.
Right.
So why don't we go over a few of them? I guess there are 11 total of these examples, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, seven of the 11 relate to Israel in some way.
Or Zionism.
Right.
Yeah. But the others, you know, are pretty straightforward, at least on their face. For example, accusing Jews as a people of being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoing committed by a single Jewish person or group, or even for acts committed by non-Jews.
Right.
On the face of it, that's
right.
That's great. There's one about making mendacious, dehumanizing, stereotypical allegations about Jews as such, or the power of Jews as collective. For example, like Jews controlling the media, economy, or government.
Right, right.
Or about denying the fact scope mechanisms of the Holocaust, of the right. genocide of Jews. These are things that I think we can agree are certainly legitimate things
examples,
to include
as
examples of anti-Semitism.
Right.
The issue is these other seven, some of them also seem kind of fine, but could be interpreted in different ways to essentially cancel a legitimate speech about Israel.
Right. So, I mean, we'll dig into two of them in a moment, but so there are seven of the 11, as we've said, either relate to Israel or Zionism. One of those is accusing the Jews as a people or Israel as a state of inventing or exaggerating the Holocaust. So there are these seven, as we said. Now let's talk about these two in particular, which really seem to be the problematic ones in terms of some of the concerns of the Palestinian Solidarity Movement. So why don't you, I guess the first one you had is the one about denying the Jewish people the right to self-determination, for example, by claiming that the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor.
Yeah, exactly. That's, I think, one of the most common ones that we see people use to say that someone talking about Palestine is crossing the line. Essentially, by saying that you can't talk about a State of Israel as a racist endeavor, this potentially rules out the possibility of talking about racist Israeli policies or practices, or talking about settler colonialism or of apartheid. For any sort of critique about the structure of Israel as a state and what that means, or of the nature of Zionism, can be seen to violate this idea that you're not respecting the Jewish people's right to self-determination.
Right, right. And in fact, you know, relating to the, you know, settler colonialism and apartheid, I mean, there's more and more of a consensus that the Israeli administrative regime does practice, there are forms of apartheid that it's practicing. Human Rights Watch just a few months ago came out with a report saying that Israel is guilty of the crimes of apartheid and persecution. Beit Salem, an Israeli human rights organization, also came out even prior to that, sort of saying that Israel is practicing apartheid. So you know, it's really difficult when you have, as you pointed out, people will actually say, well, you can't say that because that would violate this definition of anti-Semitism, which is clearly the implication here.
Right. So clearly there's an interpretation of this line, which is extremely flexible, and people can use it to try to shut down speech about all sorts of things, about legitimate complaints about the way that the Israeli state treats Palestinians.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I've mentioned the HR Human Rights Watch report, the Beit Salem report. CJPME, if you're looking for something shorter and not quite so long as some of these other reports, CJPME, we do have a fact sheet on apartheid in Israel, not just in the occupied territories, but actually in Israel. So these are things, there are racist policies in place, sadly. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that the international community be able to talk about them such that they can be addressed.
Exactly. That's why it's so dangerous to say that these kinds of complaints are effectively anti-Semitic.
Right, exactly. Now, there's a second example that I think you want to talk to as well from the illustrative examples. Why don't we go into that?
Sure. So this other example is applying double standards by requiring of it a behavior.
Requiring of Israel of it a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation.
Right, that's right. So this idea, listeners have probably heard this idea that people are holding Israel to a double standard when they criticize it. They're singling out Israel on the international stage. This itself is under IRA is seen as itself a definition of anti-Semitism, that to do this is anti-Semitic. The problem with this is who defines what a double standard is?
Right.
It's entirely subjective. It's completely up to the individual's personal idea of what's a fair criticism and what's unfair.
Right.
So having this itself as an example of anti-Semitism is really dangerous because it leaves it up to institutions to determine what is and what is not a legitimate critique of Israel. And of course, we know from doing our advocacy work that Israel supporters will claim that anything we say is an unfair criticism of Israel.
Right.
So depending on the interpretation, this example could be used about virtually any form of speech about Israel.
Right, right. And there's, you know, there is a lot of criticism out there. There's no question of that. And supporters of Israel will often say, well, the United Nations is biased against Israel because they are, you know, there are so many resolutions, so on and so forth. But part of the problem actually is that there is a repeated or ongoing aspect to Israel's abuses. It wasn't just that something happened in 1967 or something happened in 1980. Every day there are abuses that go on. So there is a certain repetitive nature of the criticisms because of the repetitive nature of the abuses, of the human rights abuses. So, yeah, it's, as you say, entirely subjective and dangerously subjective.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are just illustrative examples, right? Now, that's the way they're explained. They're illustrative examples. And we've talked a moment ago about are they part of the definition or aren't they part of the definition?
Well, this is something that's it's really not clear. There's a controversy around whether or not these illustrative examples about Israel and Zionism are actually officially a part of the IRA working definition that was adopted by the IRA alliance made up of different member countries and other groups. So for some people, they say that no, you know, only the two short sentences that I read out before, those are the only parts of the definition that have officially been adopted by the group. However, in practice, we know that people treat these things as together. So usually if a government is asked to adopt IRA definition, they're asked to adopt the examples as well. And efforts to try to de-link those two are not always successful, because they're seen as a way of trying to water down IRA.
And they're also an interpretive lens of the definition as well. Like if you go to the IRA website, they're all on one web page.
Exactly. So even if a government adopted only the short official definition, you could say it's leaving out the examples. As soon as someone is asked to actually interpret IRA, they go to the website, they find on that exact page all of the examples.
Right.
So that is a part of why it's hard to really disconnect these two things. So so from our point of view, I think it would be dangerous to sort of adopt IRA to say, well, maybe if you cut out the examples, the original definition is fine, because in practice, the two are completely connected, and it's not reasonable to separate them.
They're too highly associated,
yeah.
Well, and our own example, we were involved last year when Ontario adopted IRA by order and council, and we actually had, as you may remember, there was a conservative MPP who met with some Palestinian solidarity activists, and he assured us, this was Khalid Rashid, he assured us that the illustrative examples were not actually included in the Ontario government's adoption. And we went public with that. We released a press statement saying, yes, they haven't been adopted. And then within just a few days, Rashid Khalid backed away and said, no, I never said that. And so there is clearly this sort of, I think there's a sort of like they want to have it, want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to have it both ways. They want to say to one group, for instance, the Palestinian Solidarity groups, they want to say, no, the illustrative examples are not included. But then to maybe the proponents of the definition, they want to suggest that they are.
Right. Yeah, so absolutely.
That's sort of what we're seeing, at least in that example. now, on the IRA website, just above the illustrative examples, it says, criticism of Israel similar to that leveled against any other country cannot be regarded as anti-Semitic. So that's right there with the definition, too. Should that reassure us? Should we feel better? I mean, should that...
So a lot of people, they'll say, you know what, IRA, it absolutely does not silence speech. It, you know, criticism of Israel is fine within certain limits, which are undefined. But this, having this in there really doesn't help very much, because what's essentially it's doing, it's suggesting a distinction between legitimate and illegitimate criticism of Israel without actually saying what that is. So again, it's entirely subjective. The evidence shows that IRA's biggest supporters actually see most form of protest and criticism of Israel as illegitimate. So anyone can read this sentence and project onto it what they think it means.
Yeah.
For us, you know, for it to actually mean something, it would mean it's okay to boycott Israel, it's okay to express support for Palestinians. That would give some assurances. But IRA supporters read that sentence and they say, see, boycotts aren't allowed because that's not a legitimate form of criticism.
Right, exactly. And in just a moment, we're going to get into some specific examples of how we feel the IRA definition has been misused or misapplied. But one of the things that I find is always curious is I've been in meetings where they've sort of said, okay, well, give us an example of criticism of Israel that would be allowed. And they actually don't give you examples. So in as much as they say, yes, there are cases where that could happen, you'll never hear a proponent of the definition say, well, here's a legitimate criticism of Israel, which is sort of humorous. So, Michael, you've written an article which actually cites a number of specifically Canadian, we're just talking Canadian here, cites Canadian examples of people who've used the IRA definition in exactly the way that we're warning against. That is, using the definition to suggest that proponents of Palestinian human rights are anti-Semitic. Why don't you highlight some of the points that you made in that article?
Sure. So I wrote that almost a year ago, but there are just so many examples. I tried to bring a few together. And you can read this in Canadian Dimension, and we'll post a link to this in the description of the podcast. But, for example, last year there was this group of pro-Israel professors at the University of Toronto. They were pushing the university to adopt IRA, arguing that it would actually give the university the right, if not the obligation, to disallow BDS, the Boycott Movement Against Israel, and to abolish events like Israeli Apartheid Week. So this is a pretty explicit case of supporters of IRA saying that this is exactly how they intend it to be used to shut down activism on campuses.
Here's a tool. Here's we're giving you a tool.
Here's how you're going to do it.
Right.
Another one, B'nai B'rith Canada, a pro-Israel group, has referred to IRA to try to get university lecturers fired for criticizing Zionism, and in the case of Dr. Azarova, to block the appointment of a scholar who was critical of Israel's occupation.
So, in fact, it's not actually specifically to say that it's not actually addressing something specifically the professor said, but actually just addressing the professor as a person, that this person is dangerous.
Because
basically.
Of too much, an obsessive focus on Israel or whatever they say. That right. Again, it's not a specific criticism, it's too much criticism. Or this, we don't think that this person's criticism is motivated for the right reasons.
Right.
Therefore, they violate IRA. So it's...
So they're not actually citing something specifically she said, but it's more the issue that she talks too much about Israel.
Essentially, that case, yeah. Although in the other case with the other professor, it's about criticizing Zionism. Anyway, here's another case. Several pro-Israel advocates have written in the National Post, for example, that Canada's single vote for Palestinian self-determination at the UN, when we talked about this in a previous podcast, Canada votes against most motions on Palestine, but in favor of a single one. So these advocates are saying that that single vote violates the IHRA by denying, again, Israel the right to self-determination. But which is
suggesting somehow that the resolution denies.
It's an absurd accusation to try to say that a very mild, very inadequate, symbolic gesture of support for Palestine is inherently anti-Semitic. So that is a particularly egregious example, I think.
Yeah.
Another case, NGO Monitor, this group that. A very pro-Israel group that tries to cut the funding to various Palestinian NGOs, wants the Canadian government to apply IRA to international development funding in order to stop funding to Palestinian groups that might support a boycott of Israel, for example.
Right.
And actually, B'nai B'rith just put out a letter also. They're calling for a similar measure that funding to all NGOs, whether domestic or international, should have to abide by IRA in order to receive any government funding. So, and we know how they interpret it as anything violates IRA, certainly if you express support for Palestine or criticize Israeli policies. So these would have very real-world effects.
Absolutely. And, it's just sad. It's just so sad how far it's gone in an extreme. A boycott is inherently, it's a democratic sort of act. It's a protest. You're refusing to engage with something, refusing to purchase something, and so on. And yet, even that would be labeled, or people are using IRA to even label that as being anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. It's just so egregious. Now, those are examples from the. Were there any other articles you want? Examples you want to cite from the article?
And I don't want to belabor this too much, but I think it is important because there's so many times you'll see. Supporters of IRA say it's not meant to silence speech, and yet there's so many cases where they do say it's supposed to. So, for example, a recent op-ed by Avi Ben-Lolo, who is the head of a pro-Israel group, he wrote in the National Post that Desmond Cole, who is a very well-known anti-Black racism activist in Toronto, he wrote that Desmond Cole violated IRA in a speech to teachers by including Palestinians in a discussion of racism and settler colonialism.
Wow.
NGO Monitor and Honest Reporting Canada accused Human Rights Watch of violating IHRA by concluding that Israel is practicing the crime of apartheid, something that they came to, Human Rights Watch came to that conclusion after, you know, extensive research and documentation.
Right.
And they're saying that
painstaking,
violates IHRA. Honest Reporting Canada also complained that a student newspaper in Saskatchewan violated IHRA by describing Zionism. This was someone they quoted describing Zionism as a settler colonial movement. But by having that quote in there, that the paper was violating IHRA, and the article was actually eventually taken down in a pretty egregious case of press censorship. Here's another one. NDP MP Charlie Angus was accused of violating IHRA by a top Israeli diplomat after Charlie criticized Israel's discriminatory vaccine program, which excludes millions of Palestinians under occupation.
Yeah. These are all, I mean, we could do a podcast on each one of these, really, couldn't we? I think that the one that's most, of all these recent examples that you cited, the one that's most troubling to me is the one, the first one you mentioned, where Desmond Cole is being accused of anti-Semitism under IHRA simply because he mentioned Palestinians in a discussion of racism and settler colonialism. So, you know, here we're not even talking about singling out Israel per se, but just mentioning Palestinians and their rights and the need to include them in a discussion about racism and settler colonialism.
If anyone's singling out Israel, it is supporters of IHRA who are saying that Israel as a state that exists in the world cannot be discussed in terms of the same processes of racism that every other country is subject to.
Right.
That we can't have conversations about how these oppressions and struggles are linked.
Yeah. So there there is a certain imbalance, but it's actually an imbalance in support of Israel. Okay, so we've already mentioned the adoption of IHRA by the federal cabinet, by the Ontario government, by the Quebec government. And there's a story behind each of those that we just don't have time to get into today, and maybe a future podcast
will.
But the definition has also been adopted elsewhere. Let's talk about a few of the other, like cities, institutions, and so on.
Yeah, cities. You know, supporters of IHRA are trying to get it adopted at every level of institution, whether universities, social media companies, everyone. And cities have been an interesting case where there's actually been some pretty prominent examples where they weren't successful in passing IHRA. Motions were brought forward to Vancouver, Calgary, and Montreal recently in the last couple of years. And ultimately, those city councils decided not to adopt IHRA after facing some concerns from the public, and especially some organizing by our friends at Independent Jewish Voices.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting thing. The mechanism for how the adoption is usually approached is sort of interesting, isn't it? That as we didn't get into it with Ontario and Quebec, but there's sort of quite often it is adopted without a whole lot of public discussion around it. And it sort of feels like the proponents of the definition actually want to avoid that public discussion, doesn't it?
In the cases of both Ontario and Quebec, in fact, both provinces tried to introduce IHRA through a democratic process. When they realized they weren't going to get their way, they switched to anti-democratic, to unilaterally adopting the definition.
Just sort of
so there's definitely a recognition that the public doesn't support this definition. So institutions are going to adopt it no matter what the public thinks.
Right. Well, and I think also there's a certain fear around an open discussion around this. You know, I think to some degree you can read the definition. When I first read the definition, I thought that's reasonable and so on. But when you start talking about it and you understand why it's controversial and how you really can't separate the examples from the definition itself, that's when discussion about it is dangerous for the proponents, that they realize, gosh, or they're afraid of that there'll be public engagement, that people will understand what's wrong with it, understand why it's dangerous, what has implications not only around free speech around Palestine and Israel, but potentially free speech around other things. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is this avoidance of this public discussion.
Absolutely,
around it.
Yeah.
And so that's really, I think, part of the process. And one of my concerns, you know, when I got involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement, one of my observations, when I first got involved, I thought,
what we need to do is win the debate, right? But actually, over time, I've realized, no, what we need to do is have the debate, that the other side wants to prevent the debate. So if we could just talk about IRA, you know, I think there'd be a reluctance to adopt it. But the problem is, quite often, it's adopted without that discussion, right, which is really the danger. Now, we're not the only ones that have an issue with the IRA definition. I've been hearing about it for many years. We've raised issues about it. We have a number of statements raising issues about it and so on. But we're not the only ones who have raised issues with it. Why not? I guess there's all sorts of groups who have said that they're, you know, this is not the right way to go. Why don't you give us a few
Sure.
examples?
I'll just put some out there in sort of rapid fire. Because there's so many, but I do want to highlight some top ones. Yeah. The BC Civil Liberties Association, the Canadian Labor Congress, the Canadian Federation of Students. These are massive organizations representing lots of workers, students, people concerned about rights in Canada. More than 30 academic associations and universities have actually passed motions opposing the adoption of IRA, largely thanks to the work of the Academic Alliance Against Anti-Semitism, Racism, Colonialism, and Censorship in Canada, which is a long name, but it's a great group doing really important organizing.
They are doing fantastic work. And it's important to point out with these cases that there was open discussion. It wasn't a backroom deal. They had to talk about it, and they talked about the reasons they had, you know, the people that wanted to pass these resolutions opposing the adoption, they had to prove why they opposed it, right? It wasn't this sort of backroom thing. And I think that's very significant in this.
Yeah, these are more democratic examples, certainly, than the cases where IRA is actually adopted.
Right, yeah, continue.
Another one, there was this letter where 160 or more prominent Jewish scholars from across Canada said that the IRA working definition distracts from experiences of anti-Jewish racism and threatens to silence legitimate criticism of Israel's grave violations of international law and denial of Palestinian human and political rights. Another 600 Canadian academics signed a letter that saying that it's IRA is worded in such a way to intentionally equate legitimate criticism of Israel and advocacy for Palestinian rights with anti-Semitism.
And with the previous point, all I was going to say was, I mean, one of my observations is that, you know, it sort of takes the focus off of what we'd consider sort of traditional anti-Semitism and puts all this emphasis on Israel, where anti-Semitism, as I said early on in our podcast, it is a problem. The Statistics Canada, you know, the police departments, they are reports on anti-Semitism. It is out there.
Absolutely.
And yet I feel like this definition almost creates confusion as to what anti-Semitism is and what Jews face in certain contexts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the lead drafters of the original IRA working definition, actually, Kenneth Stern, has warned that pro-Israel groups are weaponizing it to suppress political speech. And actually, there's a lot of groups in the U.S., like liberal Zionist groups like J Street and Americans for Peace Now, who have also criticized IRA for these same reasons.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's so many more we could mention, but there's this idea that IRA, it's really not. There's absolutely no consensus. And among especially scholars who are experts in anti-Semitism studies and related fields, Middle East studies, there's definitely a lot of division over this.
Yeah. And these are people that really study these things deeply and understand the implications of a poor definition. Now, there are alternatives to IRA, aren't there? Anti-Semitism has been around for a long time, long before the definition was first proposed in 2005. I guess there's the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, which has gained some popularity as an alternative. Why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, this, I think, emerged sort of as a response to the institutional support for IRA. It's a statement signed by over 200 people, again, experts in anti-Semitism and related fields. Resolution, essentially, or framework that institutions can adopt. The bad part of it that, you know, Palestinians have raised is that it continues to put Palestine at the center of conversations around anti-Semitism, rather than, for example, white supremacy or some of the actual threats to the Jewish community are coming from. It still sort of perpetuates the idea that Palestine activism is a leading driver of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
However, despite that, it does cover a lot of ground similar to IRA, but actually makes clear distinctions. It actually carves out explicitly that things like boycotting Israel over its human rights abuses or describing Israel's system of control as apartheid or, you know, supporting a one-state solution. You know, these are not themselves anti-Semitic, and actually provides a lot of guidance in a way that undercuts a lot of the threats that come from IRA.
Yeah, which are just so significant. As you said, they explicitly say boycotting Israel for its human rights abuses is not anti-Semitic and so on. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they do, you know, identify cases where rhetoric around Israel can be linked to anti-Semitism or can feed into it. And so it actually provides helpful guidance, I think, for actually making, if you want to know actually where criticism of Israel could cross the line into anti-Semitism, the Jerusalem Declaration of Anti-Semitism gives guidance that IRA does not.
Exactly. It does provide that context. Well, my personal favorite definition of anti-Semitism is from our friends over at Independent Jewish Voices Canada. I'll read their definition. It says, anti-Semitism is racism, hostility, prejudice, vilification, discrimination, or violence, including hate crimes directed against Jews as individuals, groups, or as a collective because they are Jews. Its expression includes attributing to Jews as a group characteristics or behaviors that are perceived as dangerous, harmful, frightening, or threatening to non-Jews. And I think it really collects well some of the core ideas to anti-Semitism and some of the things that obviously Jews around the world face, including Canada.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And they make an IJV, and we're going to have a link, as Michael mentioned in our podcast notes, to the website that IJV created on this. They make some good points around their discussion of their definition, and they say it's not an exceptional form of bigotry, that people who hate, discriminate, and attack Jews also hate and discriminate and attack other protected groups, whether it be Muslims, Arabs, LGBTQ, women, indigenous, and so on. So it's not this sort of isolated racism.
Right, exactly. And I think, putting the discussion of how to combat anti-Semitism in a broader discussion of anti-racism, rather than carving out sort of an exceptional space for it, I think makes a lot of sense if we want our struggles to actually be intersectional.
Right, and that dovetails exactly with one of the points they make on their page, that it's efforts to combat discrimination against one group should be done as part of a broader effort to combat discrimination. And it's sort of, at some level, if you elevate one type of discrimination, you almost marginalize other types of discrimination and undermines the solidarity and cooperation among these groups. And of course, they point out, as we've pointed out, that of course, the state of Israel is a political entity just like any other state. Its policies, actions, and histories should be judged and criticized as appropriate and potentially harshly. And it's not, of course, by itself anti-Semitic. So there are alternatives, but the IRA definition has got a lot of momentum, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
And a lot of influential proponents.
Yeah, and we might note also that, you know, when the Canadian government adopted IRA, again, not democratically with public debate, they also introduced, or more recently, I guess, they introduced a special envoy on combating anti-Semitism, appointing Erwin Kotler, and part of the mandate is to promote IRA and to encourage institutions like universities to adopt it. And so this is something that is being pushed by the government itself to try to get a broader civil society to adopt this definition, which is harmful.
Yeah. Well, and it's certainly, I think we oppose all forms of discrimination and racism, but again, this is sort of a form of elevating one particular type of discrimination, whereas there's discrimination and racism is such a broad problem in Canada, and there's so much need, for example, to address the issue of racism against indigenous peoples and Muslims and so on. So there's really need for a much broader view, broader perspective from governmental institutions on how to address all of these types of discrimination. So, but as you say, there's a lot of institutional support for IRA, and this, you know, we're going to be hearing about it for years to come. It's going to be debated for years to come, obviously. So I guess we'll leave it at that for the moment. I'm sure we'll come back to this in future podcasts, but hopefully this podcast has given people an overview of the situation and the problematic aspects of the IRA definition. If you've liked our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about our podcast or about the broader work of CJPME, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who helped make this podcast and all of CJPME's activities possible. Thanks also to Madeline Moffitt, our podcast engineer and consultant. And that's it for now. So thanks for everyone joining with us here today. We hope you'll enjoy us with our next podcast. Take care, and we'll see you again soon.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
to make an appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence plan for your area and book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.